Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar titled Stablecoins Unpacked, Law, Policy, and Practice. Our moderator today is Gary Caldwell. Gary is the Deputy General Counsel and Director at ING Financial Holdings Corporation and Special Professor of Law at Hofstra University. His practice areas include derivatives and banking law. Previously, he was a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School and served as Executive Director, Counsel, and Chief U.S. Data Protection Officer at West LB, chairing the Global Dodd-Frank and Underwriting Committees. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers and moderator, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. After our panel gives their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We will do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Gary, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Well, thank you, Caroline, and welcome to our audience today. We're going to, just in terms of your questions, we're going to take your questions as they come. So don't feel like you need to wait until the end. As matters come up, feel free to ask away. So we have an amazing group here, an august group of people in the stablecoin field. We have Anthony Apollo, who's the Executive Director of the Wyoming Stable Token Commission. We have Professor Dan Ourie, who's a professor at Cornell Law School, and he's the author of this book, Beyond Banks, which I cannot emphasize enough how excellent this book is. I wish I had it when I first started teaching banking law over a decade ago. It's really amazing, Dan. We also have Jerome Roach, the head of legal for blockchain, crypto, and digital currencies at PayPal. And we also have Sarah Wilson, who's a general counsel and the corporate secretary for Circle. So thank you, everybody, for being here today. What a great group we have together. I also want to thank John Mark Buffo, who's not here today on the panel, but was a lot of the inspiration behind this. So thank you, John Mark. Jerome, I'm going to ask you a question that nobody on this panel needs to ask, but I'm going to ask it. What are stable coins? And what generally backs stablecoins?
Well, thank you, Gary. Happy to kick things off. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today. It's a real pleasure to participate. I consider myself lucky to be among these panelists. I want to pick up on the note that Caroline made. The views that I'm going to express today are mine and not those of PayPal. But with that, let's get on to the program. So what are stablecoins and what generally backs them? So stablecoins are a type of cryptocurrency that's designed to maintain value with respect to a reference asset. So usually that's a fiat currency like U.S. dollars, but it could be a commodity like gold or even a basket of financial instruments. And so these tokens are designed to maintain a peg to those reference assets. And they can do this either algorithmically or by maintaining underlying reserve assets and high quality liquid assets that support the peg and the price. I expect today that we'll focus largely, if not exclusively, on the tokens that are designed to maintain their value using reserve assets, and probably focus on those that are pegged to be one-to-one with U.S. dollars. And for example, and at the risk of seeming like I'm being a shameless shill, in the case of PayPal USD or PYUSD, each token that is issued is backed by at least one U.S. dollars worth of bank deposits, short-dated U.S. treasuries, and over-collateralized overnight repurchase agreements on U.S. treasuries. And so I'm often asked, if you have that sort of structure with reserve assets, aren't you sort of reliant on banks? And can't that make banks kind of a gate to how big you can scale if they might be unwilling or unable to accept the dollar deposits or act as the repo counterparties or otherwise facilitate reserve assets? asset transactions. So I'll just say in short, I don't think that's the case. And I feel more strongly about this today than I did a week ago, and more strongly about it a week ago than I did a month ago. And I think we'll get into some of the regulatory developments and sort of the wind that's at our sails on these things. But I'll just note a couple of things that I think are really helpful when thinking about stablecoin reserves. So last month, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency issued guidance stating that banks no longer need to go to the OCC and seek prior approval to do, among other things, hold deposits backing stablecoins. And so last week, the Federal Reserve issued similar relief for its banks. And so I really expect that these banks are going to see growth areas, the custody of stablecoin reserves, facilitating treasury purchases for stablecoin reserves and other reserve management activities. And that's not just my opinion. I think you can see it expressed by some of the banks. Citigroup, for example, it issued a report this month from their Citi Institute on digital dollars, and they suggested as much. So I really think we're not only seeing the development by issuers of stablecoins, by people invested in this ecosystem, but I really think we're seeing some of the points of friction that might have acted as gating issues in the past fall by the wayside.
That Citibank report, I think it had a number of upwards of $3 trillion for ultimate stablecoin issuance in 2030, you know, going up and going beyond that. So this is, you know, we're seeing a forecast from a traditional financial institution that's just skyrocketing type forecast. So just to underline what you just noted, let me follow up with you though, Jerome. Okay, so I understand schematically what it is. Although it seems to me that right now, I mean, it could be backed by deposits, it could be backed by cash, it could be, I don't, in a sense, know what it's backed by. So it seems like there's a bit of caveat emptor that I need to, some diligence that I probably need to engage in. But let's say I do that diligence, what's my use case for stablecoin? Why can't I just use PayPal's existing fiat currency peer-to-peer, you know, services for moving money?
Well, the caveat that none of my remarks should be viewed as suggesting you shouldn't use PayPal's existing fiat peer-to-peer business lines. I would say that I think stablecoins are really well suited for facilitating and affecting payments where they supplement and maybe in the future supplant the traditional fiat payment rails. So if you're thinking about wires and checks and ACH. So I tend to think of as a use case, if you're talking about something equivalent to remittances, particularly if you're talking on a cross-border basis. If you use stable coins on an optimized protocol, you're talking about being able to transfer value in for less than a dollar, sometimes less than a penny per transaction in just a few minutes, if not seconds. In contrast, and this isn't a pick on ACH, but you could be looking at 1 to 3 days for the same movement of value. And wire transfers, while potentially faster, are typically considerably more expensive. And these speed and cost differences can be something to note domestically, but they can become even more pronounced in a cross-border basis. And the one thing that I think is really critical, and again, this is not to pick impliedly on anyone who is a traditional banker, but barring a network outage, you can transfer stable coins 24/7, 365 a year. So you're not really subject to closures of financial intermediaries for holidays, for weekends, and the like. Another thing I would keep in mind is, it's very easy when you have the sort of ethnocentric US view about everyone being banked and having options. When you're talking about the rest of the world, particularly areas where there are unbanked or underbanked populations, they're increasing importance. And so I've seen recent data from Chainalysis noting that stablecoins regionally make up at least a third of all crypto held in various geographic regions. And I've seen some estimates that in the Middle East and North Africa, that stablecoins might be as much as half of all crypto held in those locations. And so I think that you're really seeing this as a growth case, and particularly again for those perhaps underserved populations.
Right. So you're cautioning for us to be careful about the U.S., which is more in favor sometimes of investment tokens, or there's a bit of a bias in people's behavior toward tokens like that. Be careful of that, because the use case, there is a use case in the United States, which you enunciated well, but it's even more profound potentially outside of the United States, where there's less developed financial infrastructure.
Yeah, I think that's right, Gary. And even within the U.S., you know, sometimes people will say to me, well, why wouldn't I just use one of the Bitcoin or ETH or another of these tokens? And I really don't think that they're necessarily fit for this purpose. I think people tend to view them as an alternative asset class. Sometimes they invest in them or purchase them for speculative purposes. They're probably most interested in price appreciation. But in contrast, you know, stablecoins, as the name suggests, it's really a stable store of value. And so I view them as a better medium of exchange for routine purchases than the non-stables. And I think, I guess I'd put it a little bit differently. You're far less likely to have buyer's remorse if you use a stable for a purchase. And I think a lot of people are probably aware that May 22nd next month is so-called Bitcoin Pizza Day. So that's the 15th anniversary coming up of what was really kind of the first very, very notorious usage of Bitcoin for a traditional transaction in lieu of using fiat. And so in 2010, a programmer famously sent 10,000 Bitcoin to someone that purchased two pizzas for them. And those two pizzas were then valued at about $40. That Bitcoin in today's valuation would be worth $1 billion with a B dollars. So I don't want to make light of that decision, and I don't think that that would, but I don't think that would happen today if you were to try to use stable coins to purchase your pizza.
Deflation there. That's super helpful, and we all look forward to Bitcoin Pizza Day and our celebrations. Anthony, I'm going to ask you a question that I was speaking to somebody from the Netherlands and said, hey, I'm doing this panel. You might be interested in, let me send you the link. And the person said, why Wyoming? Why is Wyoming issuing a stable coin? Why would a state work on digital assets to begin with? And I think it's a great question. So I'm if you don't mind, I'm going to, you know, start off with you with that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Gary. And I will quickly also say that my opinions are not those of the Stable Token Commission or the state legislature. But I will say that Wyoming is kind of undersold as an innovator. We were the first state to give women the right to vote. We were the first state to create the LLC. And about 10 years ago, all the way back in 2016, a discussion started in the state around how we could get involved in cryptocurrency, blockchain, and digital assets. Some of that was downstream of difficulty people had in the state with buying digital assets through exchanges and some changes and amendments that had to be made to the rules and statutes in the state to effectuate that. And then it kind of snowballed from there for several reasons, and they've kind of built on themselves since. So in addition to this innovative framework we always try to have, one of the things a stable token can accomplish is being the glue between different digital asset initiatives in the state. For example, we allow you to pay your taxes with crypto. We have a digital asset registry in the Secretary of State's office. Similar to our development of the LLC, we now have LLC structures that can accommodate decentralized autonomous organizations, or even the DUNAs, the decentralized unincorporated nonprofit associations. That's more of a mouthful. So when you have all these different disparate initiatives, how do you transition value across them in a digital manner that stays stable? Well, a stable token seems to be a great way to accomplish that. That's one reason. Second is Wyoming predominantly derives its revenues from oil and gas. We are a fossil fuel state. At some point, that is a finite resource that will dry up, and we need to assess what initiatives and other revenue generating potentials are available. Digital assets could certainly be one of those. And stable coins that we back with cash and short duration treasuries, very similar to the basket that Jerome mentioned just a few minutes ago, is similar to what we have, and those are interest generating. And for the Wyoming stable token, those interest earnings get deposited on a quarterly basis to the school foundation fund. So we'll create that sweep every quarter when we are live. And then one more thing I would add on top of that as to why a state would be doing this is a second crack at a fully reserved financial instruments. For those who've been following along in the state of Wyoming, you've probably heard of Caitlin Long Custodia Bank, one of the special purpose depository institutions in the state, a special type of charter that was created in the state that would have created a fully reserved bank-like structure that was able to custody digital assets. And the full weight of the prior administration came down on that structure. And as such, there's been some difficulty getting those live. But a stable token could be a second way to do that, to have a fully reserved financial instruments issued by the state and get that into circulation. To be very clear, Wyoming is not issuing a central bank digital currency. We don't have a central bank here. It is a fully backed and fiat reserved stable token. We don't call it a stable coin because we do have some, you know, concerns around the constitutional connotations there. That if we were to call this a stable coin, and Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution says states cannot mint their own coin, there could be some conflation there. So it's a bit of a semantic difference for us at the moment. But I think, you know, for us with a very similar basket of permitted investments, which is carved out in statutes, we have a statutory requirement to invest inbound dollars into cash, short duration treasuries, and repurchase agreements. It'll be fairly evident when we launch. We'll talk more about that later. But when we launch, it'll be fairly evident this is certainly not a currency. It is a stable token or stable coin, if you prefer.
Okay. So, yeah. So you're not minting a token or a coin. You're minting a curry. That's very helpful, Anthony. I do want to get back to that. I have some questions about Wyoming doing this. What does it mean for other states? But let's put that on pause for a moment. But we are definitely going to get back to that, because I do want to ask Dan something that relates to what I'm going to ask you, Anthony, about states. And that's about interoperability. What is it going to take from a policy perspective, Dan, to integrate stable coins into the payment system? Because right now it seems discrete. I can't take my bank account and directly put it into USDC, for example.
Yeah, it's going to take a lot. Thanks, Gary. As you'll know from the book, I sort of divide my world between the monetary side of things and the payment side of things. And the first thing it's going to take to integrate stablecoins into the payment system is actually a microprudential framework that allows the money of stablecoins to be safe and to be a stable store of nominal value. That's going to include things like entity and group level activity and indebtedness constraints, capital requirements. It's going to require things like full collateralization by high quality liquid assets and some way of dealing with the fact that you just can't have money and monetary claims fall into bankruptcy. There's got to be some sort of alternative to bankruptcy, the purpose of which is to resolve
I just want to pause you for just a moment, because I just want to elucidate that a little bit for the audience. One of the things you outline in your book very clearly is the difference between a general bankruptcy, where there's an automatic stay and unsecured creditors are treated the same, and the bankruptcy of a financial institution, especially a depository institution. Maybe could you outline a little bit, because you're delving into that a bit now, could you briefly just outline the distinction?
Yeah, so in effect, bankruptcy, while in the United States is a very flexible process, it has certain inflexible elements of it that are particularly problematic from the perspective of people who want to have their money now to be able to buy things, sell things, pay their rent, and people who have an expectation that a dollar today is a dollar tomorrow, and that I'm not going to wake up one morning and my stable coin is going to be worth 50 cents in the dollar. Those two things are, one, an automatic stay, which once a bankruptcy petition is filed, either prevents a holder of a stable coin from withdrawing or redeeming or otherwise transferring that asset, or requires them to go to court and explain why they think that automatic stay should be lifted. So immediately, the analogy to going to the ATM or making electronic payment breaks down, right? I've had to hire a lawyer for one thing, which should be a clue that this is about to be a costly and lengthy process. That's what bankruptcy does. That's why banks are exempt from the bankruptcy code in the United States and elsewhere. And what you get instead is the replacement of bankruptcy with a resolution process, the first and most important element of which is to make sure that people get paid rapidly in full. In the United States, up to $250,000 per account, per category, per bank. The average bankruptcy in the U.S. Lasts several years. The amount of time it takes a covered depositor in a failed bank to get their money back is a day. That's the big difference.
Yeah, understood. All right,
So that's the microprudential side of things.
Yeah.
And this is sort of the first point. Well, it's got to be safe. If it's not safe, it doesn't matter how whizzy the payments are. But the big thing at the heart of your question is then once we've made it safe, what additional policy tools do we need? What sort of environment do we need to fully integrate stablecoins in the system? The first thing is we need the basic entry pass. There needs to be access to Federal Reserve master accounts. They are the operational precondition for integration in the domestic and global payment systems that exist today. Beyond that, you're going to want to make sure that the financial market infrastructure, especially that that's owned by conventional banks or other competitors in the stablecoin space, are subject to open access rules, so you can ride your trains on other people's rails, and interoperability requirements to then answer questions about when we're dealing with different technologies, how and who should have to make the investments to make them work together. This is something that's not a payment specific issue. When we look at, for example, how to make electric chargers work for vehicles and whether you can rock up in your Prius to a Tesla charging station, these are the exact same type of issues. And there are rules in these spaces designed to make sure that people aren't using technology to build a moat around their network such that other networks can't compete on a level playing field.
Let me follow up, Dan, on just one thing you mentioned, because we have a question from the audience that, that really has a direct nexus into your description about microprudential safety.
Sure.
And so you outlined some of the criteria that you think are necessary to have a regime, a stablecoin regime that, that meets that basic standard of safety. And then I think you're talking about, hey, now how can we have a competitive framework? So, but your precondition is we first need this framework. The question we got is there a prospectus that discloses assets backing the investment? Is there a suitability requirement, such as there would be maybe in securities regulation? Yeah. So right now there really isn't in a sense, but in your model, and we'll talk about the Stable Genius Act, as it probably will be enacted in a moment, but before we get there, I just wanted to ask you that question.
Yeah, so, and I have a pretty strong view on this, and which is my way of saying that I think reasonable minds can disagree on it. The thing about money is you don't want to have to read a prospectus. The thing about money is that it should be suitable for a kid trying to buy a comic book who's just spending their allowance. It's not securities. That's why safety becomes the most important issue. That's what makes it not like securities, which often is used as sort of an analogy. And people come with that with very sort of good faith reasons in the United States because we made this mistake with money market funds, where we brought them under the guise of securities law when they are pretty much the most banky thing that you could possibly imagine, taking highly liquid, ostensibly safe assets and then using them as collateral to issue something that's supposed to have a stable nominal value, where you don't have to, when you see the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 going down that day, you don't have to go to your bank account and be, oh my goodness, did my deposit base go down? No, the point is that it won't when other things will. And if it can't achieve that, then we shouldn't be using it as money, and we definitely shouldn't be calling it a stablecoin. That's a pretty strong take on these things, but I do think that it leads to a level of clarity on the regulatory side about what we need and what we don't need in these functions. Can we still have access to those assets? Do I think it's great if I could have a credible disclosure that the banking nerds could look up and see what the profile looked like? Absolutely. I will be the guy who looks it up. But do I think that we should kid ourselves into thinking that a prospectus is protecting the everyday user of these instruments? No, I absolutely don't.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, Sarah, I know that you're in a hotel and that there's some variation, so we're going to do our best here because this really ties into something I did want to ask you, because Dan is describing some of the preconditions he thinks there should be from a safety standpoint. What elements of a stablecoin regulatory regime should this room be paying attention to? Like, you know, you're in the middle of it. You're the GC of the big the big person in the room here. So
thanks, Gary, and apologies for my Wi-Fi issues. And I will say, similar to everyone else, the statements I make are my own opinion, not those of Circle. But as you and everyone else knows, it's a very active space right now with ongoing legislation. And, you know, I think there's really three key policy metrics for, you know, evaluating green a bill and what everyone should be paying attention to is, you know, first, does it create clear standards around issuance? Are there, you know, standards around reserves? Are there disclosure requirements? Are there consumer protections? And how are holders treated in bankruptcy? Second, does it establish a bright line definition of what constitutes and can call itself a payment stable coin? There's obviously variations. You know, we consider payment stable coins of one-to-one backing with high quality reserves. And third, does it reaffirm the role of the dollar and ensure that the U.S. can speak with one voice on a global stage? Beyond that, issuers should really be subject as well to the standard suite of controls applicable to any financial institution in the United States, such as adherence to the Bank Secrecy Act. So those are really the things that everyone should be paying attention to as we, you know, look at the ongoing debates around legislation.
So the BSA requirements are going to be the same as they would be for any financial institution. And I think this may have worked perfectly. We may have gotten Sarah's remarks. I won't ask her a follow-up question yet on this. Although I do want to, Dan, let me bring it back to the Stable Act and the Genius Act. But you know, one's with the House, one's with the Senate. Let me bring it back to those. Are those achieving your safety objectives?
No, I think is probably the answer to the question. Although I think significant progress has been made over the last 6 to 8 weeks on various points. I think we are still at a place where we're trying to sort out some really thorny issues around bankruptcy. If a stablecoin is an IOU issued by a stablecoin issuer, we would conventionally understand that as a bankruptcy claim. And then we have ways of exempting those claims from the harsh strict of bankruptcy. But if there are stablecoins out there, and there are a great many of them, where the holder of the stablecoin does not have a right to payment vis-a-vis the issuer, then those sort of things don't actually fall neatly within bankruptcy at all. And so the bills, and there's still movement on this. This is still moving tonight as we speak. Sort of attempts to square that particular circle, absolutely no pun intended there. These are technical issues that are going to take a while to work out.
Well, let me ask you a very technical question. And I mean, one of our audience had is a fantastic question. There's, by the way, audience members, we see that a lot of questions are coming in. We will answer all of them. Or, you know, so feel free to keep on asking. And if we haven't answered yours yet, don't worry about it. We will get to it. But we just got one asking, do individual consumers own their stablecoin or simply have rights related to control? Your book discusses this a lot. So
this is exactly the question that gets raised in bankruptcy here. Ownership of an asset is treated differently than the right to receive payment under a debt, under all sorts of legal frameworks. And I don't have to tell sort of this audience that there are still pockets of unclarity, depending on business models, depending on market structure, that then create gray areas there where legislation can help eliminate gray areas, but legislation shouldn't drive or pave a new road over top of what is a fast evolving space where, quite frankly, these are pretty nuanced questions and, you know, some very bright minds still disagree about what the nature of the problem is and how to deal with it. But absolutely, I've seen stable coins that are 100% credit instruments, and I've seen stable coins that bear none of the legal hallmarks of a credit instrument whatsoever, effectively bearer instruments.
So does this do the Stable Act and do the Genius Act effectively address these bankruptcy issues? I mean, they seem to try.
The Genius Act is ahead of the Stable Act at this stage of the game, I think, in responding to some of this. If I could show you my inbox, which I can't, things are literally moving in this regard over the last 24, 48 hours. People are attempting to come up with language that in some way reflects the reality on the ground around the legal nature of stablecoins, such that regardless of whether it is a credit instrument claim or an asset that a stablecoin holder holds, that they will get the same treatment in the event that the issuer goes into bankruptcy. Okay. But the last thing you want is differential treatment of people who think they're holding the same instruments. All sorts of things can go wrong at that point, not the least of which is instability within something that has stable built right into the name.
Thank you. Sarah, I think you're on your cell phone now. Maybe we don't get your video. Oh, you're yeah. So we get everything. Fantastic. So I'm going to ask you a follow-up, because you were describing things that sounded very traditional finance. You're like the BSA, the Bank Secrecy Act, money, anti-money laundering. I mean, you know, this doesn't sound alien to folks who grew up in a banking environment. You know, we know that state governments are involved in this. So there's going to be a number of major players that seem to be more from traditional finance or from unexpected areas like state governments that have telegraphed that they're going to jump into this space. Will the composition of the sector change? And what new activities do you see stablecoin enabling, perhaps as a result of this broader, more democratized kind of involvement in the sector?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think inevitably a regulatory framework is going to shift the center of gravity from, you know, your crypto trading and informal sector activity that you see today to at scale institutional use. With regulatory clarity, you'll see others wanting to take advantage and jump into this space as well. If you think about it, every day over $2 trillion in global trade are subject to settlement risk, and stablecoins have the potential to reduce that. Whether it's capital markets and meeting T plus zero settlement targets, or multinationals managing their global treasuries, or even an everyday consumer sending a cross-border remittance. These are all areas that stablecoins can, you know, further and further enhance as well. But I would say it's also not just the biggest of players that are going to benefit from this either. Smaller institutions are also going to see efficiencies that have long been the purview of multinationals. If you think about a community bank, for example, with a dispersed population, it could actually set up its own stablecoin-based compliant cross-border payment flows without all the infrastructure that it goes to enabling correspondent banking. So you're going to see, you know, again, the center of gravity shift in more institutional use, which, you know, we welcome.
Okay. So you see it as enhancing the field. So you see the greater participation is going to strengthen and deepen the field.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I have a question for Jerome that's an audience question, and I want to throw it by you. And Jerome, the reason I'm asking you this question, and everybody else feel free to jump in on it, but we discussed it, I think last week this came up in a conversation we had. And the question we have is, how does mining using enormous amounts of power create value? So, and I think this is similar to what we discussed about, you know, does this create outsized energy needs, and are there attendant environmental issues that are created by all blockchains?
Yeah, thank you, Gary. So I think it's an excellent question. And I'm going to start with saying I won't sugarcoat the fact that there is indeed a considerable amount of electricity that's consumed in the operation of any blockchain, whether it's proof of work or proof of stake. That said, I think it's probably best to try to put this a little bit more in perspective. And so I would suggest if we start with something like Ethereum with its proof of stake as a starting point. And I pick it because a number of stable coins are available on the Ethereum blockchain, including my favorite, PYUSD. And I think I to try to contextualize this, so I've seen some estimates that suggest that the electricity necessary to require to power the Ethereum blockchain is orders of magnitude lower than other activities about which green concerns are seldom voiced. Now, this isn't a case about whataboutism, but if you think about it, a popular video streaming service might use as much as over 100 times more electricity than a proof-of-stake blockchain protocol. Online gaming in the United States collectively might use, and I'm not making this up, I've got this from reputable sources, as much as 10,000 times as much electricity. And it's possible if you take traditional online banking in the aggregate that it uses even more. So yes, I get that proof of work protocols use more than that. And people might say that I cherry picked an arbitrarily low baseline. But my point isn't so much about a perfect apples to apples comparison, but I just wanted to note that I think these concerns can sometimes be overstated, or at a minimum, they're just not placed in the proper context. And And so I think with any activity, including this, the right analysis isn't just looking at the cost in isolation, but comparing them against the benefits. And I think that's what gets lost in a lot of this. And I think if you take and you weigh the benefits that we've been discussing against the cost, do I wish we could consume less electricity doing this? Sure. I'm hoping there'll be more efficient ways to do this in the future. I hope there's a reliance on an ever greater number of green and eco-friendly power sources. But I do think the benefits today outweigh the cost.
Okay. Well, thank you for that candid answer and you know, for being realistic about some of the challenges. But the benchmarking I find illuminating, right? Once you benchmark it that way, it really changes perception of it. I did ask Anthony. Anthony, you know, Sarah sees a bigger tent of participants in the stablecoin area as a net positive to the ecology, the stablecoin ecology. Let me ask you, what are the pros and cons of the WYST, the Wyoming Stable Token, issued by Wyoming over privately issued stablecoins? Is it the same? Are there some advantages? Is it?
Well, I think there's certainly mostly pros, a couple cons. We'll be quick on the cons. The impetus for us to get a Wyoming Stable Token out the gate, the way that's happening is through state government, right? So we're to a certain extent running a startup inside of the Wyoming state government, and to a certain extent that is like putting a square peg in a round hole. So if you hear the refrain of, you know, from startups, you know, move fast and break things, that's not really something we have the opportunity to do. Conversely, that also has some positives that come along with it. We'd like to think that there are statutory and rules-based improvements with what Wyoming looks to offer. To give you an idea, in statute, in the Stable Token Act itself, we do have a requirement to maintain a 102% reserves buffer. So, for example, there's 100 million Wyoming stable tokens outstanding. The expectation is we'll have $102 million of reserves in the bank. And that's intended to mitigate against any kind of, you know, depegging risk, just any instance of downward pressure on the overall ecosystem or liquidity crunches. We also talked about before, this is intended to be a public good, right? So dollars coming back to the state rather than going to perhaps shareholders of a private company. And that's a way for the state to generate dollars and reduce the tax burden on its citizens. That is, you know, can replace something along the lines of legalizing and taxing recreational drugs, for example. A couple of things. We talked about statute. That's the law we have to follow. That is passed by the state legislature. For us as an agency that reports into the state legislature, we do have rulemaking authority. And there's an interesting carve out where the state of Wyoming, the Stable Token Commission, will need to promulgate rules in the state that have to go through a public comment period around how the token will operate. So last Thursday, I believe, the commission passed our rules around reserves management. So while the statute dictates what we can invest in our basket of permitted investments, the reserves management rules we've drafted are meant to make that even a more refined and robust process about how dollars will move, how tokens can be issued and redeemed, and the financial flows behind them. So while the commission approved those, now several other agencies need to approve them, and then they'll go up for a 45-day public comment period, where if, you know, U.S. citizens or beyond think that we are off the mark, they have an opportunity to tell us so, and we'll hear from them. We have a similar rule set coming up around token treatment. So I do believe Wyoming will be the first public entity in the U.S. to put forth a rule set around how things at a smart contract level will impact the issuance, redemption, any kind of burning, interdiction of stable tokens, how that will manifest. And when that does happen, we'll need to abide by those rules and they'll be publicly available. We don't have the opportunity to perhaps change our terms and conditions on a whim based on, you know, the wants of a new administration. Things will be fairly locked in. And we believe that'll give the end users of Wyoming stable tokens quite a bit of confidence that they can use the token as intended without having to worry about, you know, waking up to a different regime that oversees it. And to that extent, it is important to know that the state of Wyoming itself is doing this issuance. We are the issuer. And to that extent, we have certain sovereign benefits as well. Wyoming, while we will ostensibly report into the federal government, we are not going to be under, let's say, the aegis of the New York Department of Financial Services. Similarly, we're not going to be under the scrutiny of regulatory authorities abroad, like MiCA and the EU, the Markets and Crypto Asset Regulation Framework. But we are sort of looking to all of those different frameworks, all those different jurisdictions to look at how they are managing stable token or stable coin specifically, or digital asset issuance. But we are, and putting that all into, you know, our research and how these rules are manifesting, but we will be able to have.
That ties into to a direct concern. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just definitely wanted to address this question, because one of the audience member asked, you know, said some Latin American countries are exploring or have developed state-backed stable coins or central bank digital currencies like DREX in Brazil. How can these initiatives be balanced with the protection of individual privacy? I know you have guardrails and things, but ultimately the state of Wyoming can track every financial transaction that's using those stable tokens. Is that correct? Or?
Well, it will certainly be a bit of a balancing act. The first thing to keep in mind is Wyoming really does have a focus on privacy. For example, long before the stable token was issued, the legislature did pass a law that prohibits the disclosure of private keys in a civil or criminal proceeding. Right? We protect that as a state under free speech. There's already a lot of concern around privacy in the state, in this industry, and we were the first to do that. That rule has since been adopted by Utah and others. For us, we are looking to target what I refer to as the Goldilocks zone. We're looking at blockchains that have confidentiality or anonymity built into their parameters. What we'd love to see is a stable token that has obfuscation of addresses or amounts on a public chain. So you could have all the efficiencies of those peer-to-peer transfers, but still have it so that people who are observing the public chain don't necessarily have a ton of insight, while giving the Stable Token Commission itself insight into some of those transactions to make sure they're not being used for malicious purposes. For example, used by Hamas, used by the Lazarus Group in North Korea, which is kind of a prolific hacker in this space, and they're behind a number of attacks that we've seen along the way. So to a certain extent, it will be a balancing act, but we are looking into the anonymity proofs on several different chains, whether that could be privacy pools on Ethereum, confidential transfers on Solana, some of the interesting new developments coming on Avalanche that use a combination of zero-knowledge proofs and homomorphic encryption. We're getting pretty deep into the weeds on that to make sure that our consumers are protected.
Okay, all right. Central bank digital currency is, in a sense, a totally different discussion and topic we could be having. But I just mentioned, because, you know, when you have a state issuer, it definitely brings that into question. Sarah, you know, I mentioned DREX. I mean, the world hasn't stood still while the U.S. has worked through a stablecoin framework over the last several years. Earlier, Jerome noted that a lot of the use cases for stablecoin are actually outside of the United States. Is it too late for the U.S. to assert its role here on a global stage? And you know, is there a real meaningful way to be able to catch up here?
Yeah, that's right. Of, you know, what everyone's mentioned is that absent U.S. regulation, foreign regulators have moved to fill the void. They've moved to provide clarity in the critical technology of digital assets. You know, we've seen MiCA, we've seen regulation in Singapore, and, you know, we are seeing Japan, and we're looking at, you know, potential regulation coming down in Hong Kong, for example. And so we're seeing regulation happening abroad, and in some cases creating regulations governing the issuance of dollars. And so U.S. legislators and policymakers, I think, have heard that call. And I think that's been a major driving factor for stablecoin legislation. And, you know, if the U.S. wants to retain the dollar's leadership in this digital economy, then legislation around the digital representations of the dollar really can't wait either. And so, importantly, I think the bills affirm the U.S. regulatory primacy. And in writing the rules for the dollar and establishing a unified federal standard and reciprocity for establishing equivalence with foreign regulatory regimes, I don't think it's too late, right? The U.S. framework couldn't actually be more timely as governments around the world are wading deeper. And, you know, it's not that all of this has been online forever, and we're seeing, you know, more regulations come down throughout the world. And so I think it's very timely as we look into regulations in digital assets, and you mentioned CBDCs as well, and various countries looking to enact CBDCs. And so we're wanting to make sure that the regulation, you know, comes out prominent in the U.S. as well, to, you know, it affirmed the U.S. dollar's dominance.
Thank you, Sarah. We have an audience question, which I think it's almost like, you know, what we haven't talked about is there is a fiasco with Terra. There's a fiasco with Voyager. You know, obviously FTX, even though it's, you know, not directly related to the question at hand, but it's in the public consciousness. Dan, what additional regulation or what can we learn from, maybe tell us what happened at Terra and Voyager just super briefly, if you can, if I'm not putting you on the spot, and what can we learn from them? And, you know, what can we do in response?
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the lessons from that particular episode, I think, are pretty narrow but important, which is that language matters to people. Language sets expectations. Language is used to make people feel safe. And the use of the word stable in a mechanism, in the case of Luna, that any finance person, any financial services lawyer, if they looked at, would be like, that's not stable. I don't care if you're stable during good times. Anybody can be stable during good times. That's not stable in bad times. That's leverage. That's relying on a liquidity mechanism that disappears in bad times. And therefore, the thing that I would take away from those examples, which is becoming more prominent in the various bills working their way through Congress, is that you can't call yourself a stable coin unless you fall within the specific microprudential parameters that we're talking about. And that's there's still the provisions there, what I count as legacy provisions from about 6 or 8 drafts of the bills ago, that say we're going to look into algorithmic stable coins. For those of us who are old enough to remember things like delta hedging, it's all the same. People have been trying to create safe things out of risky things for a long time, and it works until it doesn't. So while people still hold out, I think, an idea that we might get a version of this that is somehow more financially engineered than the very simple models that are envisioned by the stablecoin legislation, in reality, if this is going to work, it can't be those things. And we need to make sure then that the name stablecoin and the usage of terms like money, currency, in product names, which are expressly designed to instill in people the expectation of safety, is something that can only be used by types of firms that meet very specific microprudential requirements. That, to me, is the big takeaway from those cases. It was... not a duck, and it was calling itself a duck. When ducks are really important to your economy, you probably shouldn't let people call things ducks that aren't ducks.
Hey, well, let's talk about ducks, and let's talk about this taxonomical question that you're raising, because stablecoins, one of the audience members asked very cogently, you know, couldn't stablecoins have different use cases? And indeed, they do. And regulated differently based on the use. There are some stable coins which are payments, and some can earn money like a money market fund. Circle's model is not that, obviously. Circle's just stable coin, although I think there's a potential post-legislation for some sort of interest model. But if we look at what builds itself as stable coins, there's often two classes. And one of the concerns you have, Dan, is that those classes are treated co-equally in bankruptcy. But maybe, do you want to jump on that? And maybe if anybody else also wants to, feel free.
I'll just say really quickly, there's a more general problem here, which is that I guarantee nobody listening to this call, when asked how they wanted to pay for their coffee this morning, said, I'll pay using deposits. Money doesn't work in a system where we start differentiating between different types of money. You paid with your Amex, or you paid with Bitcoin, you paid with whatever you were gonna pay with. But ultimately, the real key to integrating stable coins into the monetary system is that we ultimately don't call them stable coins. And I would say this is my big problem that I've had for, I suppose, about a decade now with all attempts to regulate stable coins, is that it's just money. It shouldn't matter what the technological background architecture is, because if we start calling it stable coins, the first time there's a stable coin run, guess what's going to happen? Other stable coins are going to run. This is what we've seen with cascading effects in various crises. If we start differentiating between different types of money in good times, people take that as a cue in bad times. They're risk averse. And rather than asking the question, is my stable coin better off than the stable coin that just failed? They answer that question by withdrawing from the stable coin market, because it's easier to identify because we gave it a different name. And so that's all I'll say on the taxonomy point. The rule should be that to the consumer, none of these things mean anything in 10 years.
Can't everything you said be applied mutatis mutandis to money markets?
We don't let normal human beings deal in money markets, but yes, the exact same thing applies. And we spend an awful lot of money and an awful lot of time with bubblegum and shoestring to try to keep money markets together because they're so important. But we've also made the decision that when it comes to retail money, and this is reflected in the way that we regulate banks, this is reflected in our existing regulatory architecture, is that we don't want them doing due diligence into the type of money. We want them having a good payment experience. We want them with fast, cheap, secure payments. But the moment we have to ask questions about the provenance of our money, that's the moment that a crisis is about to happen.
Right. And Sarah, let me ask you. Dan is pointing out that, you know, if people have to worry, like if, you know, my kid's buying his bubble gum and has to read a prospectus, you know, that's potentially a problem to, you know, and just like when the United States had during the era of free banking in the early 1800s, when there were all these different notes issued and you had to have these note reporters and everything, and that's complicated, or even the colonial era when it was even more of a mess. So we get that. But I think what you're suggesting, Sarah, is there can be a legislative framework, which voluntarily Circle has already implemented to a large extent, but there can be a legislative framework that lets you say, okay, I already know then that's all taken care of and that this really is stable and I can treat it indifferently to any other source of money. Is that fair?
I think that's correct. And I think, you know, if you look at, for example, the SEC statement, the division came out early April with a statement of what is a covered stablecoin, right? That is not a security. It's a payment mechanism. It's a payment instrument. And so you don't need the prospectus when it's not a security, but it's a payment instrument. And it's clear there that it's, you know, it's fully reserved. It's high quality liquid assets constitute these covered stablecoins. And so you have the safety and soundness. You have the security of knowing that this is, you know, a payment mechanism with these true payment stable coins. And I think what that's, you know, what Dan is distinguishing as well is like, you don't want to have to read a prospectus to be able to use your Amex or to be able to use your cash to make transactions. And so, you know, we really want to be able to be in a world where USDC and stable coins are just as easily used as, you know, your credit card.
Well, let me just take a poll. I mean, I think the answer is obvious on this one, but one of the audience members asked a question that I think is a natural public policy question to ask. Do you envision the FDIC insuring stablecoin? You know, if we really are going to treat money as identical, Dan, does that mean that all sources of money have to have the same legal framework and the same set of protections, or can we have different set of protections that maybe work just as well, maybe actually counterbalance each other or provide a diversification, a lowering of risk due to diversification, as well as an increase in efficiency, obviously, in their means. What do you think, Jim?
Yeah, I think that's the $64 trillion question of what's in between people's ears. Is that on the one hand, I think a lot of the folks on this panel, know legal strategies for making money safe that don't involve deposit insurance, right? There are ways of collateralizing a nominal fixed claim. There are ways of structuring that claim to limit the impact of bankruptcy. We can do all that. And I think then the $64 trillion our question is, are consumers going to trust that, or would they rather just have the safe signal that they know and that they grew up with the metaphorical insured FDIC symbol on the side of something? And I honestly don't know the answer to that question. I often think back to England in the 17th century, where we got all of this monetary innovation taking place. It really was a caveat emptor world where we're experimenting with paper money. There are coins of different types all around. And we do have this sort of sorting out that takes place over two centuries, in effect, before we settle on bank deposits as the primary source of money. And I wonder whether we're entering a smaller version of that stage now. But I do think this is the exact type of question that we're going to need to answer. We can do it, but will it be trusted? Because if it's not trusted, it's never going to be fully integrated into the payment system. And I think building public trust then is that thing that you've got to have if you're a policymaker, if you're building stable coins, if you're building networks, that you just have to have on the top of your office wall, right? Without trust, none of this works. The law can support trust, usage can support trust, but also signals and giving people things that they're comfortable with can often be a fast track to building that trust as well.
Thank you. All right. Jerome, I have a question from the audience that, I think you can help us answer specifically, because it's, you know, the question is, aren't they each simply different currencies, like euro dollars, for example, outside of the United States? You know, somebody can pay in dollars or in a local currency. Aren't stablecoin kind of similar? Just another choice. Hey, I can pay in Bitcoin. I can pay in USDC. I can pay in US dollar. By the way, when I say USDC, I'm referring to Circle stablecoin. By the way, everybody might not know that. I didn't know it. I sold my Bitcoin and my money was in USDC for ages. I'm like, what is that? I now know. But Jerome, you know, help us address that.
Yeah, so I'm a little bit leery of equating it too neatly to all of the currencies. Yes, it is a store of value. Yes, we're hoping it'll be used as a medium of exchange, and we're hoping that it's pegged to something like the US dollar, gives people comfort that it can be used as a ready substitute. But it will be backed by all the high quality reserve assets that we're talking about here, and not necessarily by the full faith and credit of an issuing central government in the case of other currencies. So I think that I would distinguish it on that basis. So hopefully, if you have faith in the U.S. dollar and the stability of it, and if you have these dollar-denominated, high-quality liquid assets that are supporting the stablecoins that we're talking about, that you can, through the transitive property, have similar degree of faith in the issuance of those stablecoins. And I'm not enough of a monetary expert to know how much you should have that degree of faith in other government currencies.
Well, one of our audience members, Rome, is targeting you. They've got you in their bullseye here because they say, how should PayPal's, and if you can't answer, it's okay, recent announcement of a 3.7% annual reward rate on stablecoins held in PayPal wallets be regulated? And then there's a mention of the recent corporate finance guidance from the SEC, whether it covers that type of product. Because stablecoins, I think, have largely not paid interest in the more, you know, more established ones heretofore. Some of the ones that had challenges did, of course, but.
Yeah, so I think the only thing I would say on this, I would try to look at this in a few different categories. One is, does a stable coin as a token itself natively generate yield or interest? That's one category. And in fact, the Genius Act specifically defines payment stable coins to not do that.
Right.
The Stable Act would have that the stable coin issuer themselves can't pay interest or yield on that. So I think there is the question about whether the token natively generates it, which might make it look more like a share of a money market fund, or if it is somewhere either the issuer or somewhere in the chain that does that. I think that is, those are two different ways of thinking about it. As far as rewards programs may go, you might want to consider whether what is the reward for? And is it more akin to a credit card reward program where you're being rewarded for your loyalty to someone? Or is it something that is intrinsically tied to the token? That's about as much as I can delve into. But I think when people start talking about yield or interest on these things, there are different categories of ways in which there might be incentives created to utilize them.
Thank you. Thank you. And yeah, that was a lot of candor. So thank you. Anthony, I have a question for you from the audience. And, you know, both the Stable and the Genius Act envision a federal and a state framework and, you know, some method of ensuring harmony among them. But it's more like our banking system, where you can have a variety of origins of a charter that has a lot of similarities. So this question is, should publicly issued stablecoins be regulated like privately issued ones? Or should there be a carve out from any act regarding regulating stablecoins? So the question is, are the Wyoming stablecoins, should they be subject to some sort of federal regulation? Should they be treated the same as USDC? Should they be treated, you know, in a special regime specifically for them? What's your view on that?
Sure. I will be somewhat grief on this one, most likely, because it is my personal opinion that the Wyoming stable token will exist outside the remit of the stable of the Genius Act. If you look at the definition of how issuers define there as persons, I'm not necessarily seeing a way to regulate states as part of that, although there's certainly a state pathway for regulation of stable tokens under a certain value, which I believe in the most recent versions of both bills is $10 billion. Once you exceed that level, there is a different level of oversight that you would be under as a stablecoin issuer, going from a state model to a federally monitored one. In terms of how we can give consumers confidence without that federal oversight, I would go back to my prior answer around what we're doing in the state through a combination of statute and a combination of rules promulgation that is essentially creating our own framework in the state that would oversee how the stable token should work, right? That's, again, the reserves management, that's the token treatment itself, and anything beyond that that touches the public, we have an obligation to create a rule set to cover that if it's not statutorily covered.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. To our audience members, there still are a bunch of questions outstanding from you all. I am so sorry that we cannot answer them all. You are a fantastic audience, only rivaled by the fantastic group of speakers we have today. Yeah. Thank you, everyone. And Caroline, over to you.
Great. Well, Gary, thank you so much. And on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our audience members and our panelists for joining us today. Thank you so much. You can keep up with us on our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.